Now, Gadolwana is a place down in the Tugela Valley. Tugela is one of the big, mighty rivers of South Africa.
This is a history lesson with many applications to the current time and place. South African MCs, listen carefully.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, man.
You know how niggas be biting and shit. Niggas be biting mad styles and shit for niggas, man. So I be hating, man. I can't stand a fucking biting ass nigga. Wanna use your lines all ahead of time before you even get a chance to shine on your own shit.
You know what I'm saying? Niggas be killing me though, son, because, you know, they be trying to be coming with your words and shit. They hate shit one word, then here they come with the word. Trying to flip it and bounce it and shit on some bullshit. Not sounding right, first of all, and shit. You know what I'm saying? Boom. But then you got niggas, son, on the real. You know what I'm saying? Niggas is biting off your album cover and shit. Boom, bad enough, they biting lines like niggas kill me. They kill me. Nobody from my clan, man. Keep it real, get your own shit, man, and be original. That's all, man.
Yeah,
and you gonna come out your own, man. Whatever, how you gonna take it, man. Fuck it.
The start's going down for you cats who don't know what's going on. This is 30 seconds. MC stepping up. It's rounds off the top of their heads, y'all. Jimmy, ready? 30 seconds. You on? Boss.
Yo, when I kick it on the mic, I kick it on prepared. I'm twice as nice, but my style isn't square. So you better recognize me when I kick metaphors. In a battle, you don't want to meet me like herbivores. So when I kick it on the mic, what you gonna see when you chose to expose my rap is so dope, my book of rhymes with an overdose too.
Sing some of that komishimuru mune. Come sing that, yeah. Ore ni ikusu mana hakori kureta hito toshi itoshi kimi ni tada negai u kono.
Ja, hier ist Polizei Herrschaft mit einer Aktionssendung heute zum Thema, ja, Südafrika. Und was wir jetzt am Anfang gehört haben, das war zuerst ein Projekt von Ulrich Süße. Wen trifft man in Durban in Südafrika? Ja, einen Komponisten aus Deutschland, der in Stuttgart lange Zeit gearbeitet hat und dann eben auch an der University von KwaZulu-Natal. Und er hat dort ein Projekt gemacht between Maskanda and Avantgarde. Das war sozusagen eine Form der Einführung, die dort in diese unterschiedlichen musikalischen Ursprünge gegeben wurde und auch die Instrumente. Und was gleichzeitig stattgefunden hat in Durban, als ich Ende Juli dort gewesen bin, Anlass war der 16. Weltkongress für Soziologie in Durban. Und das war ein Hip-Hop-Battle, der tatsächlich die gesamte Hip-Hop-Szene Durbans dort vereinigte. Und interessant sind eigentlich dann die Ursprünge, die auch in dieser Hip-Hop-Musik zusammengebracht werden. Shark Niggas, das Stück, das wir gehört haben, Listen Carefully, als Listen Carefully gedacht mit diesen Operngesangseinlagen. Das zeigt, wie sehr sich auch die unterschiedlichen kulturellen Richtungen in Durban vermischen. Durban stellt in dieser Hinsicht eine Ausnahmestadt dar in Südafrika, denn in Durban vermischen sich die unterschiedlichen Ethnien oder auch, wie sie unter der Apartheid genannt wurden. Es werden die Klassifizierung der unterschiedlichen Hautfarben heben sich langsam auf und es vermischen sich die unterschiedlichen Gruppen, könnte man sagen. Das europäische Erbe in dieser Stadt ist sehr stark britisch geprägt, aber wie in fast allen südafrikanischen Städten, die es ja noch nicht sehr lange gibt, sind dort jetzt die Gruppen so weit, die europäischen Gruppen so weit gemischt, dass man sie als afrikanisch bezeichnen muss, weil diese Form von europäischer Vermischung findet man nicht in Europa. Und das zeigte sich in vielen Gesprächen, wenn es dann darum ging, zu erklären, wann ist die eigene Familie nach Südafrika gekommen. Die frühesten sind 1680 nach Südafrika gekommen und seitdem haben sich diese Gruppen in unterschiedlicher Weise vermischt und sind in Durban auch nicht so sehr geprägt von dieser burischen Geschichte. Auf jeden Fall möchte ich diese Sendung Aktion damit beginnen, dass ich ein Interview mit Ari Sitas, einem Soziologen in Durban, spiele, der diesen Kongress organisiert hat. Und interessant ist gewesen, dass 4000 Soziologen nach Durban gekommen sind und am Ende tatsächlich die größte Beachparty überhaupt stattfand, indem diese 4000 Soziologen an den Strand gebracht wurden, um dort tatsächlich geschützt zu feiern. Geschützt in dem Sinne, dass Durban wie viele andere südafrikanische Städte gerade unter sehr starken Veränderungen leiden, könnte man sagen. Diese Veränderungen werden von den schwarzen Afrikanern als sehr positiv dargestellt. Sie fühlen sich sicherer. Die weißen Afrikaner fühlen sich sehr unsicher aufgrund der anwachsenden Kriminalität. Aber wie dies gemessen wird statistisch, das ist bisher sehr unklar. Aber die Situation am Ende war tatsächlich so, dass man es organisieren konnte, 4000 Soziologen an den Strand zu bringen. Auf jeden Fall, dies war fast ein Probelauf für den World Cup, der in 4 Jahren dort ausgerichtet werden soll. Die Städte sind dabei, sich darauf einzustellen. In Durban versucht man dies, indem man auch dann eine Straßenbahn zum Beispiel baut. Das Stadion wird gerade abgerissen und dort, auch in der Nähe des Strandes, wird das neue Stadion errichtet und dann kann man tatsächlich in Durban oder auch in ganz Südafrika, aber in Durban speziell einen World Cup erleben, wo man tatsächlich direkt nach dem Spiel an den Strand gehen kann. Diese Aspekte jetzt nach zuerst das Gespräch mit Arisitas, dann werde ich einen Städteplaner spielen, ein Interview mit Richard Dobson, der tatsächlich über diese Veränderung in der Stadt Durban an sich spricht. Bill Freund, der ein jetzt über die afrikanischen Städte geschrieben hat, der wird über Durban speziell sprechen. Durban, das müsste man, sollte man wissen, ist eine der Städte, die die größte indische Community außerhalb Indiens beherbergt. Und diese indische Community entwickelt auch einen starken Einfluss in der Zwischenzeit auf die ökonomische Entwicklung in Durban. Interessant ist auch, dass Gandhi auch eine Zeit lang in Durban gelebt hat, und auch darüber hat Bill Freund einiges zu sagen. Dann werde ich auch einen Auszug spielen, Lokile Moleve, die bei Agenda arbeitet. Agenda ist ein Radio- und ja, journalistisches Projekt in Durban, und sie wird erklären, wie man dort mit Radio arbeitet. Und dann werden wir sehen, wie sich die Sendung weiterentwickelt. Das jetzt erstmal für die erste Stunde.
Yeah, the Congress, how you wanted to start to say something about the Congress?
Well, when I was elected vice president responsible for the program, the agenda was clear that it will have to be different from the old days, and it has had to bring African dilemmas of a global concern central to it, and I took that as the mandate.
Yeah.
Also, I constructed a program committee that was as widely representative as possible from the all corners of the of the world, in order to spread the Congress and bring in the Latin Americans and, you know, the Asians and so on.
Yeah.
That was successful. The program committee worked very hard to define those themes, you know, like, the theme of the Congress and the symposia. And then it was the hard work of just convincing my African colleagues that the ISA is serious about being open to the South and being open to their concerns, and not being a Western European or American club.
Yeah.
So that was, in a sense, the mandate of getting the Congress. And the minute you start thinking of African participation, the discipline itself is more, is differently structured from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You had, in the old days, whatever you were on the continent, you had to belong to African studies, not sociology.
Yeah.
Whether you were a historian, a sociologist, a geographer, whatever, you ended up in London at the School of Oriental and African Studies. You know, never meeting with sociologists. So a lot of the scholarship is in African studies.
Yeah.
Also, given the centrality of performance on the continent in more than proscenium arch type of ways, it's part of both social life, of social movements, of all kinds of activities.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite belong to ethnomusicology or to the history of art or this. It talks to sociology, so I wanted to get some of that stuff into the Congress as well.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think CODESRIA and the various associations in Africa agreed that they were coming. We even raised quite a substantial amount of funds to subsidize, not to fully pay for people, to subsidize the difference of price that it would have involved. And there was for the first time, up to 15% of the participants in the Congress were from the African continent.
Yeah.
So that for me was, you know, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
Because it allowed people to meet, discuss, form networks.
Yeah.
Meet the Latin Americans, meet the progressive Europeans, meet the Asians and start saying, comparing notes.
Yeah.
So that was fine. But it was, for the last 3 months, myself and a room full of intelligent slaves had to work to get this, to put this together. Unfortunately, we couldn't get it to coincide with the film festival, and also we couldn't get it coincide with the Jomba music thing that's going to happen now because of prior arrangements. I wanted all that to happen around the Congress, so delegates could go, you know, and look at other things.
Yeah.
But that we failed.
All right. But if the film festival and the music festival, they have different dates, then it's probably difficult to change that.
Yeah, it is difficult because of other film festivals all over the world, because there is a network to shift.
Engage.
War and peace, traumas, and so on is another one. Bland social movements, language and art.
Yeah.
It's another one, including the transatlantic contributions, and race, apartheid, and reconstruction would be another one.
Reconciliation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those, so now starts the hard work, because even if people didn't come, they sent their papers.
Yeah.
So they didn't come because of some. Some serious reason. So it would be nice, you know, in terms of research networks as well. It was wonderful to have the Brazilians there, our research associations, and the Indian research associations.
Yeah.
And funding will not be a problem, you know, in terms of any further initiatives. So I think you know, I am exhausted. I'm, you know, I need a break, but I'm starting a major course now, so I don't have any time to.
A major course?
Yeah, about 32 master students, you know, starting teaching immediately after the Congress. So
which
I can get.
Subjects?
Well, it's a program we call Global Studies, and the students are from all over the world. They start from Freiburg the first semester, they come to Durban the second semester, and then they go to New Delhi the third semester. And then they write their thesis. So they have arrived. And they're everywhere. Mexico, from Brazil, from India, from China, from Germany, from, you know, so it's a genuinely international course. So all I need now is kind of 2-3 weeks off just to go to the beach and do nothing. And
now it's raining. Oh, yeah. But, I mean, probably you could remember how you started, maybe as a sociologist, because as I know, you work about performative literature as well. So how is the connection between what you are doing as a poet and as a sociologist?
Well, you know, at first, my creative side started from the theater in Johannesburg. And we formed the Junction Avenue Theatre Company. And it involved William Kentridge and Ramolao Makene and Sidiwe Kumalo and Arthur Molepo and others. You know, so we were doing plays, and we became the first non-racial kind of cooperative. And all of them have gone to become very famous in their own right subsequently. And then I got involved in doing workers' theatre in the trade union movement. And that I did in Johannesburg. I started from Johannesburg and continued in Durban. So I was always involved. Now, sociology was almost happening parallel to all that. For a while, my scholarships were paying for the rent in order to do creative work and political work. At some stage, my supervisors, who were, I don't know whether you know them, Eddie and David Webster. David Webster was a professor who was assassinated in the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, so so they were. They said finally they can't justify getting more scholarships unless I produce a PhD. And then people like Fatima Meer and Rob Lambert offered me a job in Durban to help start the industrial sociology. So, in a sense, poetry, I started really writing poetry in the mid-80s. And it was happening in the after hours. You know, so there would be political work, create, you know, sociological work and so on. And then I would reflect on the poetry allowed me to start reflecting on all kinds of things in a new way. And all of a sudden there were enough poems to put together the first collection, Tropical Scars, which was reviewed wonderfully at that time. All of a sudden, without even trying, I was known as a poet. You know, so... And I continued, you know, just working. But it's never been a full-time occupation. And increasingly theater, I can't be involved because of a good piece needs minimum 6 months work. So I write every now and again for the theater, but I don't have the time to produce anything. So that's why poetry is easier because it goes with me. You know, there's no there's no problem there. So in a sense, the one talks to each other, and if you look at my so-called sociology book, Theoretical Parables, it is taking storytelling to its limits of how you can use storytelling to theorize about the social.
What kind of storytelling?
Well, listening to a lot of the popular folklore and stories in the grassroots and in the various movements I was involved in, I realized that they were playing more than an entertainment role, and that there were ways of transmitting know-hows about the world. And I thought, well, if this is possible, let's try them. Let's transform the stories using the same motifs as in the popular, but to theorize now about the social. And that is, you know, it was an experiment. People have enjoyed it. But it's one example where creative narratives meet sociology. Otherwise, the two are slightly different, and I have to divide my brain sometimes. But there's nothing, you know, just I find that being involved in the arts and creative stuff makes me feel better as a human being. You know, it's more, I get more fulfillment from that rather than a survey of 10,000 South Africans and what they think about this and that. I do both.
That's very good. So to do both during apartheid, how would you probably define social existence or the quality of social existence during apartheid, and how, what is your idea? How would you describe this kind of quality of social existence now in this post-apartheid country? From your personal view.
Okay. I would like nobody to relive the 70s and 80s in South Africa because it was a horrible time. And yet, a lot of the companionships, comradeships, friendships, looking after each other, created a community of care that survived the transition. Now there is an intergenerational problem. The youth, you know, who have grown through times of freedom, want to explore their own identities, and they're very sick of the kind of stuff that Pitika and I are concerned about. But there is dialogue with them. I think that what there have been some policy mistakes in an attempt to attract foreign investment and to dress ourselves up for success and make South Africa dynamic, these neoliberal economic policies have really made poverty, have spread poverty, but also have created a lot of wealth.
New middle class.
And unfortunately, and that's what we were drafting just now, because we're going to put a statement out by all kinds of intellectuals. At the moment, the values, civic values, are being overtaken by a very ruthless attempt by an African middle class to move towards real class power. No, it's about power. It's not about values anymore. So there's these tensions.
And how do you feel under this pressure of power of this new class?
Well, I feel that, you know, look, I think the liberation struggle was not about making a few people rich or more people rich.
Yeah.
I'm the last one to say that any race should have the monopoly of having the right to exploit others.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, you know, but that's not what the liberation movement was about.
Yeah.
It was about what is in the Freedom Charter and various interpretations of that. And it was about balancing equality and freedom, you know, in a way that redistributed to the have-nots in profound ways. And that is failing, you know, at the moment. So there is awareness of that, and there are attempts to change some of the policies.
Yeah.
But everyday life is complex. You know, there is fear. There are rapes. HIV is spreading. Schools are not working properly. The prison system is a mess. You know, you just look at social failures everywhere, and yet there are movements. On the other hand, there are freedoms and lots of exciting things happening.
Yeah.
So it's a balance between nightmares and wonderful breakthroughs at this stage.
Yeah.
I feel that the democratic art policies have just basically redistributed a little bit to everyone.
Yeah.
But nobody can do much with what is being redistributed by the state.
Yeah.
But still, there's a lot of wonderful creativity around that, despite that happens despite funding, despite poverty.
Yeah.
And that's one of the hopeful things at the moment.
Yeah. And you grew up in which part of South Africa? If you grew
Johannesburg.
Up? Johannesburg.
And Durban since 1982, end of 1982.
And your family came from where?
My side of the family is of Cypriot descent. Yeah.
Okay.
And so there's a Greekness somewhere.
But only Cypriot or more?
Well, my mother is grown up Cypriot and Greek, but she is German Jewish. Mother moved to the island in 1930.
Yeah.
Left her man, who was a professor of art at Hamburg. Now he's been rediscovered as a major Jugendstil and Art Deco professor, but he stayed on and he was gassed. I don't know. Nobody knows exactly when. But so that's where she grew up Greek in the town where, in Limassol, in Cyprus.
Yes.
That's where she met my father as well. And she was a very well noted Cypriot folklorist. And, you know, so there's that. And of course, it's the Greekness. Of course, there were Turkish uncles and Beirut relatives and Alexandria relatives, you know, so it's that Mediterranean soup that is involved. But it grew up in kind of the anti-colonial ferment in Cyprus against Britain.
Yeah.
and then Greekness emerged.
Yeah.
And the island has got headaches since.
It's, yeah.
But most of my, you know, Durban since 1980, end of 1982.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's what, 24 years here.
All right.
So I'm part of the furniture.
Yeah. The furniture. Now telephone cables. Not wireless. But it's really interesting what I experienced here is that it's a melting pot of Europeans who are mixed up, which we cannot found, and this mixture we cannot found in Europe. So maybe could this colonial story probably rewritten in a way that it was, that there was always migration and it was always kind of more migration history, like the Zulus came into to South Africa as well as migrants. So maybe could it be possible to rewrite a story of migration without forgetting really the colonial structures? But I think the colonial structures are really disappearing in the way how everybody is a migrant here and or mixed up with different different European countries. So the Europeans here are really Africans, I would say, how they have, how they lose their European identity.
Yeah. Well, the story of migration is a complicated one, because that was the founding myth of apartheid, that the Nguni people and the Sotho were also like the Afrikaners. And therefore there was, it was a terra nullis.
Yeah.
And therefore there was no colonization.
Okay.
So that's you know, the record is complex, because archaeology has not caught up with all kinds of findings.
Yeah.
And there are things up the rivers here that show a settled Zulu-like, Nguni-like agrarian society that goes to 1000 AD.
Okay, which is
so, which is much earlier than what people are saying. People migrated.
All right.
So, but that hasn't been explored properly. One knows that the south of the Limpopo there are cliques, and therefore there was intermarriage and intermixing, and also violence and whatever between Nguni, Sotho, and the Khoisan.
Yeah.
And you know, the, there was much more intermixing than people have said historically.
Yeah.
There are findings of Persian coins. There are, you know that the Chinese were in Madagascar for sure.
Yeah.
Before Columbus and so on. So it's very difficult to tell that story clearly.
All right.
But yes, a lot of the South African whites are totally local. You know, there's no other.
Yeah.
You know, there was a myth of Europeanness, and when they go to Europe, they feel alienated. You know, they.
Yeah.
And it is a kind of, it's not quite a melting pot.
Yeah.
And the race is still very important. And ethnicities are coming up, but it's moving in a certain direction.
Yeah,
and a very interesting direction.
Yeah,
like, you know, just looking at my son's generation, who's now 22. He has gone through a school where it was, his classes were non-racial. Or there's no race in his generation, that is. That
yeah, no race, but you are the most classified society I ever met.
Yes, yes. So and that is why they...
What is the difference between this being classified and race?
Well, what is a color?
Yeah.
What is a color? You know, most of the so-called coloreds now come to university are children of black and white people. In the post, you know, or approaching the post-apartheid period, you know, so do you remove them into colored areas, you know,
or gray areas?
Yeah, it's becoming absurd, you know, the classification, colored.
Yeah.
Indian is sometimes used, sometimes Indians say, no, we're not, we're South African.
Yeah.
And so, but there are essentialisms at the same time, you know, or purity that are beginning to happen.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that classification reinvents race all the time.
Yeah.
And yet you need it in order to look at redistribution.
Yeah.
You know, whether it happens or not.
Yeah.
But increasingly you find people who refuse to enter, you know, to write anything in the categories,
yeah,
in the questionnaires that they're given.
Yeah.
What are you? They just leave it blank.
Yeah.
You know, so, it is the most classified society. And that is the old headache of apartheid. That's what...
Yeah.
Surviving to this day.
And as the whites were probably more classified than the blacks, or?
No.
No? No. So do you have different black classifications? Like you have different white classifications?
Yeah.
And?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
So to come back to the arts, how would you say the role of artists like William Kentridge, is that because I mean his works are really, they have a kind of poetic structure, and when I remember his works and see how people are working on the streets out of in the bushlands, then I can imagine what's always how artists define in a way through their identity. How would you describe artists' identities here in to come, how they are working when they are sculptors? Mm. What is the meaning of these, of the artworks?
Well,
in relation to social structures, maybe.
Yeah, you know, there are, you know, like William has become a global
player.
And, you know, galleries are constructing him in all kinds of ways as the most important hypermodernist, postmodernist, or whatever artist globally. The thing is that because his art speaks to many people in different ways, and it's accomplished, it's well crafted, it's the eye and the hand, what they do, and it's inventive, it's theatrical, and his experiences from the theater, but also his experiences, you know, because what people don't know, you know, because William was not a product of a fine art school.
Yeah.
He was a product of the theater, of political science, of philosophy, of and a lot of talent.
Yeah.
And he would be there in mass gatherings, and he would watch for the gesture, not watch for the politics of the event, but what is being... You can see it in his...
Yeah.
In his drawings. I don't know whether you've seen some of these films, little films, you know, just the coffee pot that turns into a mine.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's all about metamorphosis.
Yeah.
And the marches, you know, just processions, and the loud hailers, and, you know, it's all about, you know, kind of an abstract insurrection in disquiet.
Yeah, or an orchestra of life here.
Yeah. So he's constructed, on the one hand, as a global player, but he is, in a sense, one of the people who has become canonical now. You know, just in South Africa.
He is, but I heard that it's difficult because a lot of the art students who are coming now to study art, they are not so well educated, and they don't know who Kentridge is. Mm.
Yeah.
So there's a big... We know him, but...
But let's say when he was here at the Red Eye last year, his first appearance, in a sense, in Durban, and he showed one of his projections, there were 1,000 people at the City Hall.
Yeah.
And it was a... mixed wow. crowd, you know.
Yeah.
He is not known by lots of young people coming up, but he's known by lots of them too.
Yeah.
And all the, you know, Vega College of the Arts and everybody just shows the stuff. But yeah, you know, he is not as well known as he should be, you know, in terms of stylistically, but he's known as a name. His itinerary now is global, you know, so he doesn't have much time for South Africa.
Yeah.
Because all the works immediately, he can't draw fast enough. You know, because
it's horrible.
And then now with his work with operas.
Yeah.
And you know, he is working in Brussels, he's working in Germany, he's working in New York, he's working.
Yeah. But
his impulses are very, very local.
Yeah.
You know, he'll hang around and look at things and
That's what I experienced as well. And the role of the crafts now, how is, because there's always here isn't such a separation between crafts and arts in a way. And how are crafts becoming art? And what is the meaning of craft in Europe?
I think that is also being constructed by the export industry, by the tourism industry.
You
know, it was much more fluid in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And, you know, art was what, let's say, white artists called art.
Yeah.
In terms of what was happening in the townships.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there were these movements like Rockstrift and others here that started creating an identity for black artists.
Yeah.
And there, the Institute of Race Relations here played a very important role.
Yeah.
So Sifiso Mkame, Paul Sibisi, Jali, and others were part of the 1970s to 1980s. Self-conscious, we are township artists, and our distinct voice is because we are of the people, with the people.
Yeah.
But a lot of their techniques were the grassroots techniques learned that could be called craft at the same time.
Yeah.